From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When Tony DeCoppel was growing up, he thought his father was a realtor and antiques dealer. Who told you that?
My mother told me that. That's what I told other people's parents. That's what I told friends.
It wasn't until he was almost 30 that DeCoppel discovered his father was one of the biggest marijuana smugglers on the East Coast in the 1970s and 80s.
For a single job, he was busted for importing and distributing 35,000 pounds of marijuana, which is 17 tons.
That was one operation, or that was the sum of his operations?
That was a single operation.
When Tony DeCoppel was 10, his father left the family. DeCoppel investigates his father's life and his drug operation in his new memoir, The Last Pirate. Also, Milo Miles reviews a Grateful Dead concert recorded 40 years ago that's just been released for the first time. Milo was at that concert. That's on Fresh Air. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you smoked Colombian weed in the 1970s and 80s, my guest, Tony DeCopel, would like to thank you. He says you paid for his swim lessons and kept him in the best private school in South Florida, at least for a little while. His father was a marijuana dealer and smuggler. He started off selling marijuana during the Nixon era and expanded his operation until he became a partner in what DeCopel describes as the biggest East Coast dope ring of the Reagan years, smuggling marijuana into the U.S. But DeCopel didn't know this until many years later because his parents didn't tell him. His mother continued to keep the secret after his father disappeared from their lives when DeCopel was 10. When he did find out, he wanted to know the whole story. He combed through court documents and newspaper files and interviewed DEA agents who investigated the case, as well as more than a dozen smugglers and dealers, including his father. Tony DeCopel has written a new book called The Last Pirate, A Father, His Son, and the Golden Age of Marijuana. He's currently a senior writer for NBC News and is a former senior reporter for Newsweek. He's reported on recent changes in marijuana laws and on the new entrepreneurs who are growing and selling marijuana. Tony DeCopel, welcome back to Fresh Air. The last time we talked, it was so much about the issues. It's really good to have you back to talk about your life and your father's life. So I think the best way of getting the overview of your father's achievements in dealing and smuggling marijuana is to have you read from the opening chapter. Could you do that for us?
Absolutely. By his late 20s, my father sold bricks of Mexican reefer every weekend, sometimes from the window of a Good Humor ice cream truck. By the time he was 30, he moved hundreds of pounds a month in the trunk of an old Buick crisscrossing the mid-Atlantic states under the guise of delivering concert tickets. When he'd saved enough money, he flew to Miami, uninvited and alone, to knock on the door of a former car mechanic who imported tons of Colombian marijuana. He pitched himself as the most reliable black marketeer on the East Coast, the best there is from box to box, drugs to cash. He drove mobile homes packed with weed out of Key West, secured a fleet of pickup trucks from New England, and began to transport acres of South American mountainside up the I-95 Reefer Express. This was the late 1970s, I should add, which is also about the same time that he decided to start a family. He became a father the year he graduated to loads of 10 and 20,000 pounds of marijuana, transported on freighters and tugboats from the extreme northeastern edge of Colombia to sailboats near the Virgin Islands and ultimately to New York City wholesalers, vacation markets, and college towns along the East Coast. In the years that followed, he buried nearly $1 million, invested more than a half million more in a Yukon gold mine, and prepared the paperwork of escape, should he ever have to hit reset as a card-carrying union welder and avid user of the Monmouth, New Jersey library system. At his peak in the mid-1980s, which was also the peak of the drug war and an impossibly late date for pot smuggling, he broke a weeks-long national dope panic, a drought that New York Magazine dubbed Reefer Sadness. In a single load, he supplied enough marijuana to levitate every college-aged person in America and send them sideways to the store for snacks. By that time, the old man, as he'd come to be called in the business, ran stateside operations for one of the most successful marijuana rings of the 20th century.
Well, very impressive work for a marijuana smuggler. How old were you when you found out the scope of his operation?
Geez, I was pushing 30 by the time I found out. I had heard rumors that my family was involved in the business, but I thought it was typical hippie stuff. As far as I knew, my father sold real estate in Vermont and had an antique business.
Who told you that?
They told me that. My mother told me that. And that was the narrative. That's what I told other people's parents. That's what I told friends. And then I decided to do a background check on my father. I wasn't getting straight answers from him. I'd become a journalist. I knew how to do a court record search. At first, I did a local search just in Florida, things that had been digitized, and I found nothing of significance. And I sighed a little bit because I was kind of hoping, you know, he had been nothing of significance in my life. And it, in a funny way, I wanted to discover that he had been a great smuggler.
You hadn't seen him till there was a long period of your life where he was totally absent, like from the age of 10 until you were an adult.
My father, the last contact we had was letters when I was 10. And it's not even clear to me that I read those letters. I think my mother kept them but never showed them to me. Mm-hmm. So for all intents and purposes, there was more than 20 years in which he wasn't in my life at all.
So back to your background check.
Yeah, so the background check. I called the National Archives, which is the keeper of 1% of all the paperwork that the federal government produces for all time. The most important things, the things that they think historians will care about in the future. And I said, do you happen to have a criminal record for this individual? Thinking I'd get nothing. And then I get an email with a faxed document inside of it a couple weeks later. I click it open. And it's my father's indictment, 1986. And for a single job in that year, he was busted for importing and distributing 35,000 pounds of marijuana, which is 17 tons, which if you think that a joint, a very thick joint, has about a gram of marijuana, you can roll millions and millions of joints in 35,000 pounds of marijuana. It was enough to roll a joint for every college-age person in America at that time.
And that
a huge
was,
amount.
That was one operation or that was the sum of his operations?
That was a single operation. He had been doing that every year for years at that point, for 8 years at that scale. And the work, he'd begun selling pounds, keys, he called them, the Mexican reefer was on the metric system, kilos, 1971. And so 1986, this is 15 years later, it's the pinnacle of his career, and it's quite the pinnacle. I mean, it's impressive. So then I called my mother, and I said, hey, I got this indictment from 1986. What do you know about that? And she silent for a second, and then she says, we were going to tell you.
Eventually.
we were going to tell you. We were going to tell you. And I said, well, when? And she said, well, right about now seemed right, but then you started getting that journalist bug, so we just let you find out.
Okay. My guess is Tony DeCoppola, and what he found out was that his father was a huge smuggler of marijuana, and his new book about his father is called The Last Pirate, A Father, His Son, and the Golden Age of Marijuana. Early on in your father's career as a marijuana smuggler and dealer, he was dealing to rock bands, and you referred to this in your reading. He was he had been like a ticket distributor, and in distributing tickets for rock concerts, correct me if I'm wrong here, he managed to also have contacts in bands, and he sold the marijuana.
Absolutely. So one of the coolest jobs in America in the 1970s, other than marijuana dealer, was ticket seller, because you weren't the guy in the booth with alphabetized envelopes. You had an actual paper ticket that you had to drive around to clothing stores and radio stations and sandwich shops, and that's where people would actually buy their concert tickets. And he would do that, making marijuana drops in addition to ticket drops. And then when the concert actually occurred, he would be there with the organizer, who was at the time the kingpin for that little area. My father was just starting out. And the smoke that filled the arena while the band Alabama was playing, you know, it'd be their dope.
So in talking about your father's work smuggling drugs, you talk about how the drug laws changed during that period. And you say in 1969, when Nixon took office, he started a war on drugs, and soon Congress passed the Controlled Substances Act. How did that change the law about marijuana?
So marijuana famously was categorized as a Schedule I drug in 1970. Nixon was the one who did this, and it classed it in the same category as heroin, a drug with no medical value and with a high potential for abuse. So the very thing that was exploding in use among young people, greatest flouting of law since Prohibition, was the thing that he considered to be the most dangerous substance, among the most dangerous substances in the country. So in 1970, Congress passed the Controlled Substances Act, and this was Richard Nixon's centerpiece effort to control drug use nationwide. And importantly, marijuana wasn't considered a small problem. It was considered a huge problem. It was Schedule I, and all the might of the federal government was used to try to push it out of the country.
So Nixon starts the war on drugs. How does that affect the early part of your father's life dealing and smuggling marijuana?
It creates the opportunity to be a hero. Use among his friends and among college kids is going through the roof. The government is trying to take it away. The kids want it. He can provide it. Timothy Leary, in 1969, in an article that was then reprinted over and over again, called the drug dealer, the marijuana dealer, one of the three most significant figures of the era, as big as rock stars, as big as underground artists, and then ultimately he concluded bigger than both.
In part because President Carter favored initially decriminalization of marijuana. Your father was preparing for the decriminalization and possibly even legalization of marijuana. He didn't see that during his career. What was he doing to prepare? How did he change his operation?
So my father might have gotten out of the business, and thus my life would be very, very different in 1976, because the market for Mexican marijuana, which was his product, was falling apart. But at that same time, Jimmy Carter was running for office on a platform of decriminalizing marijuana. And then in 1977, he stood on the floor of Congress and he said, the penalties against drug use should in no case be more severe than the problems caused by the drug itself. And so that is the golden hour of the golden era of marijuana. The president of the United States is saying we should soften drug laws. The advocates are saying this is going to be fully legal by 1980. That was the feeling in 1977. So my father, of course, was not going to drop out. He wasn't going to become a teacher. He was on the ground floor of something huge.
So he could no longer deal Mexican marijuana. What had happened to the market from Mexico?
Mexican marijuana was exciting at first, but by the late 1970s, there was a magazine called High Times that had been founded and spread, 4 million readers a month, and that magazine began to teach smokers about quality. You couldn't just have average marijuana grown on a mountainside in Mexico. You needed to have a particular potency. And not only that, you needed to have a story behind the weed. When you rolled it at your party, you wanted to be able to say, this came from an exotic locale. Here's how it was processed. Here's how it was packaged. Mexico didn't have a good story. Of course, you know, the tourism board will tell you that Mexico was plenty exotic, and it is. It has jungles, and it has ruins, and it has outlaw history. But the people who read High Times and the editors of High Times started pushing Colombian. Colombian emerged as the great sexy get. It's what you needed if you wanted to be a big-time dealer. And so my father needed to get Colombian. And so he did. And that was his trip to Miami in 1977. He, through sheer luck, his sister, my aunt, had moved to Miami to go to school, and she met a car mechanic who had only a motorcycle but a desire to sell marijuana. So off the back of this motorcycle, he sold a single bale and did well enough to get another bale and another bale. And then he bought a van, and the operation got bigger and bigger. He ended up being a middleman between Cuban gangsters who were bringing Colombian dope to the Keys and then pushing it into wholesale markets in Louisiana and North Carolina. And my father just went down and knocked on the door one day, uninvited, and believed on sheer charisma, power of personality, he could talk his way into this guy's operation. And he did.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tony DeCoppola, and his new book, The Last Pirate, is about his father, who was a major marijuana smuggler in the 1970s and 80s. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Tony DeCoppola. We're talking about his new memoir, The Last Pirate, A Father, His Son, and the Golden Age of Marijuana. And it's about his father, whose name is also Tony DeCoppola, who was a major marijuana smuggler in the 1970s and 80s. So your father starts smuggling marijuana from Colombia up the east coast of the United States. What can you describe about that operation?
In the late 1970s, 90% of the marijuana was coming into Florida. It was primarily Colombian. Some of it was Jamaican. My father's weed would be delivered to an old fishing shack in the Keys. The Keys are this archipelago of islands off the coast of Florida. They arc toward Cancun, deep into the Caribbean. And it's only one road that connects that string of that necklace of islands. And everyone knew that was the source of that was the road on which marijuana was smuggled in the country. And so to smuggle on that road took an incredible amount of tolerance for risk. And my father, despite being a partner in the operation, volunteered for $25,000 a shot to drive Winnebagos of weed out of the Keys and into America, just for the sheer thrill of it. He had no financial reason to do it. He had no operational reason to do it. Somebody else could have taken on that job. But by then, he was addicted to the sensation of it, to the risk.
And then he got even bigger in that operation, right? Or created his own.
He created his own. So by 1978, he had a reputation. He was not only moving tons out of Key West, but in his wholesale market in New York City and points north, he had become known as a reliable guy, as a guy who could sell quickly and then send a wave of money back down south, all the way to the islands, all the way to Colombia, all the way to the farmer on a hillside. And so a bigger smuggler, the DEA says the biggest smuggler of the era, a man named Willie Terry, could get all the marijuana he needed out of South America, and he just needed somebody to sell it. He didn't like his old partner because his old partner had diversified in the cocaine, and Willie, like my father, believed that cocaine was something you don't want to get involved in. It was bad news to sell it. Marijuana was freedom and joy, and cocaine was a soul killer. So he sought a partner who shared his values, and he yanked a chain of associations that led to my dad. My dad was that guy. And then from 1978 to 86, that's when the huge job started. It wasn't just Winnebago loads. It was multiple sailboats with tons on it apiece, and my father was the guy there in the tall grass to receive it.
And then ship it by what, up the East Coast?
Oh, he had two trucks. He had a fish truck, and he had a truck marked Global Moving. And he just cycled, he just recycled those. You know, they had a mechanic who was on staff, for example, you might have a drop point in Maryland where three sailboats would go. Both trucks would be there. They'd make a drop. They'd take it to the stash house, which was usually in Connecticut, and then go to the second drop point. So three more sailboats would head further north, maybe go to Maine or Massachusetts, and the trucks by then would be able to beat them to the point, pick up the load and go to the stash house, and the load would be parceled out from there.
So after your father, like, how old were you when your father got out of the smuggling business and then started using a lot of drugs and bottoming out?
I was six years old.
Uh-huh, okay.
Yeah, I was 6 years old. My father retires. He has, at that point, $500,000 buried in a hillside in New Mexico. He's got a couple coolers of money on Long Island. He has a safe deposit box with cash in it. Plus, he has the proceeds from his final job. He's essentially set for life. All he has to do is nothing, and it proves to be the only thing he can't do. He goes to St. Thomas, where they rent the long sailboat built for 49 people and party with just 12 on it. And me and two other kids, smugglers' kids, my mother, one of his partner's girlfriend, an old partner, they have catered meals and tour the islands, and it's a retirement party. It's a celebration. There are red snapper sandwiches and Carl Hiaasen novels and crab legs and wonderfully cut fruit, and it should just be a happy time. But my father felt uncomfortable in those situations. He felt like he needed more. He needed to be different. And so I have a memory of him leaving. We docked the boat. There are days still to come in the celebration, and he walks away. And, you know, memory is like surveillance footage. Everything gets picked up, but you don't really review it unless there's an incident. And so at the time, it didn't occur to me that this was the last time I was going to see him in any kind of healthy condition. But in retrospect, that's the last time I saw him whole. I saw him with vigor and at a kind of peak. And it was all downhill from there.
And was it the last time you saw him for a long time, too?
I saw him one other time. No, I saw him at a rehab facility a couple years later, maybe 3 years later. And we went fishing on a little man-made lake with those short fishing poles, those pathetic little things. It left me with the sensation that, it left me with the impression that my father was a failure. I had no idea about the dealing, of course. I thought he was an addict.
He was an addict, but you had no idea about the dealing.
I know.
But he was an addict. Yeah.
So I see him. So in my memory, I have him walking away in 1986, and it's the last time I see him with a glow, you know, with health, with youth, with success, with like the full flush of life. And then there are a few rehab moments after that, but until I'm an adult, I don't see him.
Tony DiCoppo will be back in the second half of the show. His new book is called The Last Pirate, A Father, His Son, and the Golden Age of Marijuana. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, boats, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. And from Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, critic Milo Miles reviews a Grateful Dead concert recorded 40 years ago that's been released for the first time. Milo was at the show and can now confirm it was exceptional. Also, Tony DiCoppo tells us how his father went from being a marijuana millionaire to semi-homeless, often sleeping in the lifeguard chair on the beach. We'll also hear how he was busted years after his final smuggle. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tony DiCoppo, author of the new book, The Last Pirate, A Father, His Son, and the Golden Age of Marijuana. DiCoppo's father was a marijuana dealer and smuggler in the 1970s and 80s. He became a partner in what DiCoppo describes as the biggest East Coast dope ring of the Reagan years. His parents separated when he was young, and his father dropped out of sight when DiCoppo was 10 after retiring from the business. It wasn't until DiCoppo was about 30 that he found out about his father's dealing and smuggling. It's a really complicated, crazy story, the way your father finally gets arrested for a 1986 smuggling operation, but he gets arrested for several years later in the early 1990s. And it's a complicated story. Let's try to make it really simple, which is going to be impossible because the person, the person who gives his name to the federal agents is actually not only your father's former partner, but the person who became your mother's boyfriend and then husband, your stepfather.
I was the best man at the wedding. Yes.
And in fact, one of the reasons you say that your mother and stepfather were in love, but that one of the main reasons your mother married your stepfather was that so she would be exempted from testifying against him. You don't have to testify against a spouse.
Right. Anyone who's seen Breaking Bad knows that you can't be compelled to testify against your spouse. My father bought him out after 86, lost everything, ended up homeless. He was in love with romanticism, and so, of course, even in homelessness, he's living a romantic life. He's sleeping in lifeguard stands on Miami Beach. And he begins to climb back up into some kind of mainstream existence. He gets a job cleaning the beach on Miami Beach in 1990. He's going to Narcotics Anonymous meetings. And at that time, as he's trying to make his way back toward me, back toward fatherhood, back toward normalcy, one of Reagan's task forces, the New England Drug and Organized Crime Task Force, is closing in on the ring that my father was part of. It busts Willie Terry, who was the smuggler extraordinaire in Portugal at that time. He went to Portugal to live the high life, but he couldn't, like my father, continued to live excessively, and he gets noticed as a white guy with a Ferrari in a resort town in Portugal. The feds go to visit him. They bust him at the dentist. They put him in jail there, and they say, if you cooperate, we can get you out and get you back home. So he agrees. And the person that he turns along with him to make the case, to confirm what he's saying, is my stepfather. This was a difficult thing to discover in the reporting process. According to my stepfather's close friends, my stepfather had a plan, and that plan was: we know that your father has money buried. We know that the feds don't know about it. If I cooperate, I can get immunity for myself. I can lock off your mother as a source of information, and we can dig up that cash. It can be ours, and who cares if Big Tony goes to jail? And so that's what they did. It's crazy.
And
it's
they found the money that was buried, that was stashed.
They did. Yeah, they went to New Mexico. My mother went with me in a Winnebago because you can't take that kind of money on an airplane, and she dug it up. My father claimed it was $500,000, and I believe him. She claims it was about $375,000, and that's what they lived on in the years that followed. They didn't manage it particularly well. And then after the cooperation with the feds, my life gets cracked in half. So up to that point, I'm living incredibly comfortably. Going to fantastic private school. We're going on Caribbean vacations all the time. Everything I would want, I have. And then suddenly, we don't have any money anymore of significance. The money is pittered away, and suddenly, instead of a rich kid, I'm being called poor boy. I have two halves of a life, and those halves don't cohere, and it's incredibly disjointing and confusing. There was a lot of mystery that I had to. There were questions, big questions I had about how that could have happened, and I didn't know the answers to them until I reported this book.
How has your identity, your personal identity, been changed knowing that your father was a very successful drug smuggler before he became a very sick drug addict?
Reporting this book and learning what I have about my father was confirming of my own sense of self. So as someone raised primarily by my mother, I never recognized myself in her. She's wonderful. She's natively wise and accepting in these interesting ways. But she didn't have the same energy I had. She didn't really look like me. Interests didn't always align. And I clearly came from some other stock. And my father was not the stock I wanted to accept for a long time because my only impressions of him were negative. But once I saw what his career was like and how it aligned with the times and the excitement and how good he was at it, I saw, oh, okay, that is a nervous system I recognize, in fact. I don't want to underplay the degree to which it was crushing to go through high school and college without clarity on where you came from and with a sense that your father was an empty vessel. It was more than crushing. I mean, I walked a very fine line between living and dying in years after college because I felt, you know, the message that society pushes is like father, like son. We say you can do anything with your life, but next to that, we say like father, like son. And I bought into the idea of like father, like son. I felt that there was an inevitability that I would end up like him, and I wanted to give up on that. I wanted to end it before it happened. And so I did become very close to ending it. And now, having written this book, I'm capable of seeing, I had to come to the realization that my father's destiny was one that he selected. He had autonomy over it. He wanted it. He regrets none of it. And therefore, if he can make his life, I can make mine. I don't have to be him. I can be, what I can inherit from him is the autonomy to be whatever I want.
Is what made you most afraid of becoming like him, was it the fact that he seemed to be either schizophrenic or bipolar or both?
Okay, so the mental health component of this is a tricky one because, I mean, yes, that's a huge part of it. I felt like, but it's not only that. I felt like I didn't recognize myself and my mother, and here was my father, a bombed out, mentally ill, recovering addict, and I felt like those are the synapses that I have firing right now. And so why don't I just skip ahead in the story? Why do I have to make a fight against my nature?
Were you having any symptoms then, or were you very depressed?
Yeah, I was very depressed in college. Yes, definitely. I wasn't having symptoms of deeper mental illness, but I had more than average depression, and I did my best to fight it, and you know, was not particularly successful. But
I'm just wondering, and talk about your father's need for risk. Do you think he was always prone to depression and risk kind of got him out of that because of all the adrenaline or whatever or all the focus?
I think my father is like a shark. A shark has to move or it sinks. And he needed sensation. And in the absence of sensation, his mood sunk and his mind came apart. So it was move or die for him. And I recognize that.
In yourself?
I recognize that in myself, absolutely. And, you know, I would think that in a very fundamental way, I've merely found more healthy and societally acceptable expressions for the very same tendencies that he has, right? I probably have an addiction to work in a way he had addiction to substances. I have addiction to the thrill of a certain kind of success in my line of work. And it's chemically the same thing, but it's neurochemically the same thing, but we view it differently.
My guest is Tony DeCopel. His new book is called The Last Pirate: A Father, His Son, and the Golden Age of Marijuana. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Tony DeCopel, is the author of the new book, The Last Pirate, A Father, His Son, and the Golden Age of Marijuana. His father was a marijuana dealer and smuggler in the 70s and 80s and was a partner in what DeCopel describes as the biggest East Coast dope ring of the Reagan years. His last big smuggle was in 1986, but he wasn't arrested until 1992. So your father was really very lucky in the respect that once he was in, once he was sentenced, he was given a very relatively minimum sentence because the operation that he was busted for was in 1986. And minimum mandatory sentencing didn't go into effect until after that, and it wasn't retroactive to crimes committed before. So he was he just managed to get by without a really long stay in prison.
Yes, he just managed. He also cooperated, right? I would like to say my father was a stand-up pirate, but he was not. He was fully willing to share what he knew about other people in the business. I mean, he was kind of honorable. He didn't implicate my mother. He didn't try to, as far as I can tell. He didn't implicate some of his down-market dealers. And as a result, he wasn't prosecuted under the continuing criminal enterprise statutes, which would have given him a much longer stay in prison. In fact, one of his partners was and got 10 years. Ultimately, you know, my father tried to live by this pirate code, and the biggest aspect of that code is that you don't tell. And he told. He definitely told.
And he's not the only one, obviously.
He's not the only one. I had this amazing interview with the former mayor of Las Vegas, who made his money as a lawyer for many reputed mobsters. And I was talking to him about how terrible things had gotten in Las Vegas during the recession. And I had all the power in the interview was on my side of the table. And then we took this little detour into personal stuff. And he'd heard about my father, read something I'd written about it or said. And he asked how long my father went to jail. And he said, oh, he did about a year and a half in custody and all. And then he points at me and he says, your father's a rat. And I was like, yeah, you know, that changed the dynamic of that interview.
How has investigating your father's story, his story as a marijuana outlaw, and also his story as a drug user, affected your, you might not want to answer this, but affected your personal use or abstinence from drugs?
Okay, so why am I not a drug addict is basically the question that people are often interested in. You have all of the risk factors. You know, absentee father, history of abuse in the family, how could you be upstanding? And I just got lucky in a very specific way. I can't handle liquor. I don't have the cauldron for it. I have a weak stomach. And that's important because there's no way for me to consistently participate in a life of debauchery as much as I would like to on some really deep cellular level. I just can't do it. I feel sick. And the prerequisite for serious substance abuse is, you know, insides made of iron, and I don't have them. Pure luck.
So you have such a complicated relationship with your father. Do you see him now? Like, is he well now?
No, my father is not particularly well. I do see him. He lives in Boston. He lives in Cambridge. You know, the theme in my father's life is romance, romance, romance. And of course, now he's not just a bum living off government proceeds. He's a Harvard bum. So he lives in public housing. He was never charged with tax fraud, so he gets Social Security that he paid as a dealer. And so he lives in public housing near Cambridge. He walks around Harvard's campus. He got a loaner bike, an English country bike from the 1950s, you know, one of these gorgeous things that would be very hip in any major city. And he rides along the Charles River, and he collapses in the grass and watches the girls run. And then when he gets tired, he goes to yoga at the senior center and gets a free sandwich. And, like, he's living a great life. But it's a pretty dented-up life. I was with him recently, and we were printing out some pictures of his grandkids. And the the guy behind the counter who knew my father, because it was a local shop, and he said, "Oh, your name's Tony too." And I said, "Yeah, I'm his son." And the guy goes, "Oh, I thought you were his lawyer." okay. so I guess we make an unusual pair. My father's got scars on his face from blackouts and from a prison fight, and he looks like a guy who has been on the longest all-night bus trip in history. Like, he's just been sleeping upright in a greasy bus chair for the last 10 years. Like, that is the level of health that he exudes. He projects sickness, basically. But a romantic kind of sickness.
So your father walked out on you and your mother when you were 10. It was years before you saw him again. And, you know, he did time in prison. He became a broken man and a drug addict. But he gave you this incredible legacy, which is not what he intended, I think, to give you, or not certainly not what you expected to get, which is his story. I mean, for a writer, his story isn't necessarily the story a son would want, but it's a story a writer could use, and you did. So
how do I feel about exploiting my father for personal gain? I feel fantastic about it because I feel he participates it.
That wasn't going to be my question, but go ahead.
Oh, no. I mean, my father disinherited me one orgasm, one hit, one high-rise hotel room at a time, and he knows this, and he feels bad about it, and he knows that he can repay me in some small way by taking me back through it. By including me, right? I was always in the dark, and now in writing this book, there was a way in which he put his arm around my shoulder and opened a side door and took me into a world that I hadn't known existed. And it was a gift. And now in telling the story, because I'm a writer, I get a personal gain, but I also, this is what I love to do. So life could have turned out very differently, and there for a long time I wished my father was just a guy who worked for IBM or the equivalent, but now I wouldn't have it any other way. So ultimately, having come out of the other end of a terrible tunnel, I feel a strange kind of gratefulness, and I can admit that I'm partially proud of my father, and I'm happy that he's my dad.
Tony DeCoppel, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Tony DeCoppel's new book is called The Last Pirate, A Father, His Son, and the Golden Age of Marijuana. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. I would bet that a lot of people who were getting high on the marijuana that DeCoppel's father smuggled into the U.S. in the 70s and 80s were smoking it at Grateful Dead concerts. A Dead concert from 40 years ago has just been released for the first time. Critic Milo Miles was at that concert and will have a review after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The one time the Grateful Dead played in Montana was in May 1974, and critic Milo Miles was there. The show has finally been released under the title Dave's Picks Volume 9. Milo takes us for a stroll down Memory Lane, or in this case, the Harry Adams Fieldhouse. Thank you.
attention, she was calling.
Same week that Neil Young introduced his Pono music player, designed to spark a huge boost in audio fidelity, I listened for the first time to a recording of a Grateful Dead concert I attended almost 40 years ago. And I realized that passions about good-sounding music go through cycles. Today, the lo-fi medium is MP3s through earbuds. Back when the Dead Show happened, it was amplified rock and roll in sports arenas. The one time the Grateful Dead ever performed in Montana was at the Harry Adams Fieldhouse at the University of Montana in Missoula, where I was about to graduate from college. This was a major event, since rock shows were rare around Montana back then. You had to motor to San Francisco or at least Denver to have more than minimal live rock experience. I knew one thing about the few rock concerts I had seen. The force of the music could overwhelm the senses, but it sounded lousy, blaring and distorted, with often incomprehensible vocals. It happened in spaces designed more for hockey rinks and basketballers than electrified hippies. This Grateful Dead show was not like that, as you can hear on the finally released live album, Dave's Picks, Volume 9. People forget nowadays that the Grateful Dead sound engineer, Owsley Stanley, was as dedicated to superior music systems as he was to manufacturing LSD. Harsh sound is a major bummer. Stanley's solution in 1974 was the enormous conglomeration of amps and speakers called the Wall of Sound. Now, I am hardly an audiophile zealot, but if you look up Grateful Dead and Wall of Sound on the internet, you'll find a lot of information that will fascinate. At every other arena show I had heard, the only decent-sounding place to be was right in front of the stage. Awed by the wall of sound, I walked all around the Harry Adams Fieldhouse, and it was like Jerry Garcia was picking guitar right next to me. There have been complaints that the wall of sound slighted vocals or had distinct tinniness. None of that is evident in the gorgeous sound mix of Dave's Picks, Volume 9. It was particularly satisfying to confirm that the version of the then-unreleased U.S. Blues was as fresh and forceful as I long remembered. Of course, I'm affected by my dazzled fans' memories, but this does seem like an exceptional Grateful Dead gig. Many even very strong Dead shows have a period where the band's impulses get out of sync, and the momentum gets lost for a few, or quite a few, minutes. That doesn't happen here, even in the extended Weather Report suite that incorporates Dark Star and China Doll. Just as surprising, keyboardist Keith Goodchild and his wife, singer Donna, are at their most precise and restrained. Their ability to enrich the band's sound is evident. I remember the Dead and the rock-starved crowd of 8,000-plus seemed to be having fun together as the second set finished with Going Down the Road Feeling Bad. I never saw a Montana audience as crazy for an encore as that one, especially in those more stoic Westerner days. Unfortunately, as the group came back out, some member of the crowd showed enthusiasm by heaving a plastic beer stein at the stage and clonking Bob Weir on the head. They played one more Saturday night and left for good. In the mythologizing way that comes with Grateful Dead territory, I've always wondered if that late moment of bad karma kept the show unreleased all these years.
Milo Miles reviewed Dave's Picks, Volume 9, the 1974 recording of the time the Dead played in Montana. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. John Sheehan directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from LifeLock, reminding consumers that identity thieves are going after tax refunds by filing fake returns. More at LifeLock.com, code NPR. From America's Natural Gas, learn how Florida Power and Light combines solar and natural gas to generate electricity 24 hours a day. ThinkAboutIt.org. And from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients at CancerCenter.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, how the stock market is kind of rigged, favoring high-frequency traders who receive and send information fractions of a second sooner than other traders. We talk with Michael Lewis about his new book, Flash Boys. It offers a picture of the hidden parts of today's electronic stock markets. Join us.